this is Feb Stokes, the podcast series of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies from Brussels. My name is Laszlo Andor. I'm the Secretary General of FEBS, and today I am in London meeting at King's College Professor Jonathan Portes, who is a professor of economics and public policy. He's also a senior fellow at a think tank, which is called UK in a Changing Europe. And in his previous life, he was also chief economist of the Cabinet Office, mentioning this just to highlight his experience in government in at a time when the United Kingdom was still in the European Union, dealing with important subjects like labor mobility. And that was the reason for we met some time ago. And I suppose, despite because it happened, this remains an interesting topic for the future as well. But indeed, I would like to start with the questions of UK-EU relations, because your think tank has been focusing on this. And we have had high hopes that once this very, very shambolic conservative government would be out and many, many safe pairs of hands come with the new Labour government, there would be an opportunity, a chance for improving relations between the European Union and the United Kingdom. How do you see it from central London?
Well, I think that the tone of the relationship has certainly improved. You do not get the same sort of anti-European rhetoric that you frequently got even under the Sunak government, let alone the previous Truss and Johnson governments. So the mood music is considerably more positive here than it was before. And that also reflects the natural instincts of the people who are in charge. You refer to them as safe pairs of hands. And there's no doubt that, you know, pretty much everybody, probably everybody in the current cabinet voted against Brexit. They would all prefer Brexit had not happened. And while that does not mean, we'll get onto this no doubt, that they want to or intend to reverse Brexit, it colours the way they think. None of them thinks that Brexit is a sort of huge economic bonus or opportunity for the UK. But equally, they are very much focused, as their counterparts on the EU side are, on, you know, where do we go from here? And then you get into a whole bunch of very, very difficult practical questions. So the fact that you are not going to get the same belligerent rhetoric about, for example, fishing rights that you would have undoubtedly had under a Conservative government, does not mean that there is somehow going to be an easier agreement, or that it's politically possible for either the UK or the EU side just to sign up to whatever the other side wants on fishing. So we are going to have a very standard, protracted, messy, unpleasant in parts, and generally unsatisfactory negotiation about fishing. And of course, fishing is from an economic perspective, just a tiny part of the whole UK and EU relationship.
But very symbolic.
But quite symbolic, yes. So at the rhetorical and genuinely at the sort of how the new government thinks about the EU and Europe, a huge change for the better. But that does not mean that we are somehow back in some sort of pre-Brexit utopia, not that that ever existed, nor does it mean things are going to be easy. There are a lot of quite difficult, complicated and painful negotiations to come, even to make fairly modest progress on some of the outstanding issues.
Yes, how the government thinks indeed is crucial, but then the question is how do people think? And we, of course, monitor public opinion, and there have been some changes, correct me if I'm wrong, towards a more positive attitude. But then the question is, what can be done if a lot of people believe that they voted the wrong way, or they were misled, or they were given the wrong information, and there is a certain amount of regret. Of course, it's not total regret, but maybe a critical number of percentages would shift if there would be a referendum tomorrow?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is that sort of question about what would happen if there were a referendum tomorrow are not terribly useful as a guide to what would happen, since there isn't going to be a referendum tomorrow. There is no prospect of a referendum anytime soon. What do we actually know, and what does that mean? I think what we know is that the vast majority of the British public think that Brexit has worked out badly. But within that, it is very difficult to find anyone who honestly say the UK is in a better position because of Brexit than it would have been without Brexit, or that Brexit has in some sense succeeded. Even the people who say they say that think that don't really mean it, to be absolutely frank. On the other hand, within that large group of people who think Brexit hasn't worked out very well, there are a wide variety of different perspectives. There are people who think Brexit hasn't worked, it could never have worked, and we should just rejoin. Mm. But that's a significant proportion of the population, but probably not a majority. Mm. There are people who think Brexit was a bad idea. It was probably always a bad idea. And this includes quite a lot of people who voted for Brexit and quite a lot of people who voted against Brexit. Has not been a success, but we need to make the best of it, partly because, well, we had a referendum, we voted, and that's democracy, and partly because, and I think, unpicking Brexit would be as messy and unpleasant as doing Brexit was in the first place, and you shouldn't underestimate the number of people who found the whole Brexit experience either unpleasant, boring, counterproductive, a waste of time, or all of the above, and don't want to go through that again. And again, those are people on both sides of the original debate, and therefore think that we have to make the best of it. And there's a wide variety of views on what make the best of it means. And then, of course, there are people who think, people who voted Leave, who think the true Brexit has not been tried, like true communism. If we just redoubled our efforts and did more Brexit, that somehow it would all magically succeed. And some people who say that believe it genuinely. Some people are just saying it because it's a politically convenient thing for them to be said, because it can never be contradicted. But trying to assemble a coherent coalition out of all of these, and then there is a group of people who claim that the true Brexit, like true communism, has never been tried, and if we just redouble our efforts and do more Brexit, somehow it will magically be better than the Brexit we currently have. Some people who say that actually believe it. Some people just say it because conveniently you can never really disprove, just as you can't disprove the fact that there might be a version of communism which actually works, you can't disprove the idea there might be a version of Brexit which actually works, mm-hmm. no matter how much the real world seems to say otherwise. Now, I think the test for this government is how do you construct a policy which appeals not to all of those groups, because of course you can't appeal to all of them, but to a reasonably convincing majority of them. And I think they haven't really decided what that looks like, and in particular, what version of Brexit that might involve a significantly closer degree of economic reintegration with the EU might be acceptable to the majority of the population.
Because in Brussels, I believe a lot of people view these questions as having at least some low-hanging fruits. Because if we are rational on both sides, perhaps we can identify a couple of issues where the first steps could be made. For example, the mobility of the young people, including or not including Erasmus, but some kind of scheme which would be seen as beneficial from both sides, and you can go for it. Is this a realistic strategy, in your view?
I think it's entirely it's entirely realistic, and it's entirely deliverable. There's actually, we have no particular reason to believe that the British public has overall that there's anything more than a small minority of the British public which has any significant objection to some form of youth mobility scheme between the UK and the EU. There are very real concerns and issues about free movement, both real ones, as it were, and political ones. But a youth mobility scheme, I think, is entirely feasible. And it would be quite possible to construct one which would be clearly be in the interests both of the of young people, both here and in the rest of the EU, as well as at the margin being quite positive from an economic point of view. Although I don't think actually the economic, the economics or labour market impacts of youth mobility are the main reason for doing it. There are other good reasons. I think the test here, though, and this is a real test for the UK government, is whether it's prepared to face down the British press, which will be some elements of which will try and paint this quite falsely as some sort of return to free movement, and some elements in the government and in the Labour Party or elements of the Labour Party, which, while understanding that this is not free movement, are paranoid that this will somehow provoke a huge public backlash, despite the fact there is very little evidence that it actually will provoke such a backlash. Mm-hmm. But at some point, Starmer and other senior cabinet ministers have to actually just say, actually, yes, we're going to do this. It's an important part of any reset with the EU. It's not such a big deal. It's not a big deal politically. And we're just going to ignore the people who scream about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an important litmus test for them, whether they're actually prepared just to say, actually, we're just going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm wondering about the political dimension of this, because the right is divided, right? You have the Conservative Party, Reform Party, and at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, the Liberal Party has strengthened, right? So in a way, the political environment would be favourable for these kind of steps, no? Correct me.
I, as I say, I do not think there is there are big political obstacles to doing it, except actually a bit of courage and the being prepared to say, actually, the people who are objecting to this are scaremongering and they have very little political base in the country as a whole. There is really no polling evidence to suggest that there's a significant element of the public that really thinks that a youth mobility scheme is somehow a threat to British sovereignty or whatever it is that is claimed. But I think it is a litmus test for the government as to whether they're prepared to actually say to the fringe minority, no, we're not going to pay any attention to you. This is in the interest of the UK. It's an important element of any reset with the EU. And it's actually a good thing for our young people as well. So we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Yes.
I think the migration and the free movement has always been subject of this heated discussions. But deeper down, probably the whole Brexit debate was linked to broader questions of the political economy. What kind of growth model, what kind of political economy on the continent, the Rhine model, people prefer, and let's say a higher dose of neoliberalism on the British side, especially when the Conservatives govern. Why do I mention this? Because part of the narrative 10 years ago was that the Eurozone is a mess, and there was a big crisis, too long, macroeconomic mismanagement, and Britain should not be chained to this economic system. And now there is also an ambition visible on the side of the government, which is not Tory, that they would like to be the fastest growing economy among the G7. And I wonder how this plays a role. Would anyone think that a kind of reintegration or integration steps would help the British economy growing, or vice versa?
So I think there's two questions there. First, I think one interesting thing about Brexit is that it has revealed two things. One, perhaps not surprising, is that the sort of myth of that the UK had somehow an American-style neoliberal model in contrast to continental European economies was always a myth. We've always, in fact, the UK has always been squarely in the European model, reflecting the fact that, of course, there are very different European models. I mean, our model has some elements of the Scandinavian one, some elements of the French one, some elements of the of other slightly more liberal models, but we're still very much a European country. And I think if you look at our economic performance over the last half century, you know, actually, in aggregate, as my colleague John Springford at the Centre for European Reform, you know, we haven't been that different from France. Mm-hmm. Same size country, same relative growth rates in many respects. So I think what Brexit has revealed, actually, I think, is that it wasn't because we were a member of the EU. It's just the natural feature of being a European, not an EU, but a European social democracy. That's our political economy. Mm-hmm. And leaving the EU has not changed that, right? We have not chosen to become Hong Kong or Singapore or Texas.
You didn't have a bonfire of regulations?
We didn't have a bonfire of regulations. We didn't have a massive cut in taxes or whatever. And the reason we didn't is because it was never being in the EU which really stopped us doing that. The main thing which stopped us doing that was that's not what the British public wants. It's not what our political and economic system is built on. Mm-hmm. You know. And so leaving in the EU didn't change the fundamental character of UK political economy. So, of course, we didn't have some sort of massive tax cuts and bonfire regulation, because it wasn't really mostly the EU which was ever stopping us doing that. I think that and we saw that in the years afterwards. In fact, the Johnson government was in some ways quite an interventionist, relatively mm-hmm. Government in a number of ways, and you know, this government has continued that. So I don't think Brexit was ever likely to mean that we were going to pursue some radical neoliberal model, and indeed we have not. And I think in that way it's been quite useful. It's sort of stripped away this sort of illusion that somehow we were being forced into mm-hmm. doing things which actually we always want to do. On the growth. And I think that is also useful in the sense that, you know, it's revealed the fact that we have very similar issues and problems to the large continental European economies in or out of the EU. We have our growth performance over the last 15 years pre-Brexit, since the financial crisis, has not been what we would have liked. And that's true of the UK, mm-hmm. it's true of France, it's true of Germany, and it's true of the Eurozone as a whole. It's not true of some, you know, perhaps catch-up economies farther to the east, which have done better. But overall, it's true, and of course, this is both the UK and the EU have a certain degree of angst over our current growth performance and our current relative growth performance.
That brings me to the next question, because I think the UK and the European Union could work together on issues which matter for both, even if there is no membership or there's not a lot of talk yes. about membership. And one of these questions is indeed, as you pointed to, the importance of this is growth. And the tendency to look for industrial policy as a tool to enhance competitiveness. Is there a similarity here? Are we both in the school of Mazzucato and you're looking for this kind of interventionism and mission-oriented investment strategies, or there is still divergence?
I think there's a fair amount of convergence at the sort of intellectual level in that in both the EU and in individual Eurozone countries and in the UK, there is a recognition that we have not invested enough. There has not been enough public investment. There has not been enough private investment. We have not been directive enough in terms of ensuring that we, again, that both public and that public investment is growth enhancing, is sufficient in quantity and is growth enhancing. We have not been directive enough at the government level in ensuring that we create the right conditions to lever in more public private investment in the industries of the future and in areas where we know we need to invest more, in particular the transition to net zero and so on. So at that level, I think there is absolutely a sort of shared view of the world. I think where, again, both the UK and individual European countries and the EU as a whole are struggling in as well, you know, given that analysis, how do you actually deliver? How do you do that in a fiscally constrained environment? How do you actually persuade the private sector to invest if you don't have unlimited amounts of government money to subsidize mm-hmm. them? And, you know, there are a whole bunch of sort of very practical questions. And so which we need to address both at the level of the individual country and in some sense collectively. And again, I don't think there's a sort of ideological at the intellectual and ideological level, the vision is shared. How do you actually do it practically, I think, are the questions we're all struggling with. Mm-hmm. Can we benefit from cooperating on this? Yes, absolutely.
Do you think Mario Draghi offers the answer to this in his famous study or report?
Well, I think, as usual, it's much easier to offer answers in reports
than it is
to actually deliver it at a, you know, in governments and in politics. So I think much of what Draghi says is extremely sensible. Much of it has been said by other reports or other analyses before. But the challenge is really to the politicians mm-hmm. In the EU and in individual countries, and then similarly in the UK, as to actually delivering it.
I think it's very interesting now that both France and Germany are, in a way, in a kind of fiscal crisis.
Yes.
And to see how they struggle with their fiscal limitations in a national context might bring some kind of acknowledgement about that it's the European Union level which would need to be the one that provides the fiscal space and the investment capacity.
I mean, one always hopes that this, you know, that crises will provoke a positive change, and that sometimes you need a crisis to overcome mm-hmm. you know, deep political institutional barriers. You know, in the case of Germany, an absurd obsession with a particular version of fiscal probity, which mm-hmm. hardly anybody, even in Germany now, thinks make any economic sense. And in France, with a sort of dysfunctional political system, which again has made doing sensible, you know, fiscal policy very difficult for a long mm-hmm. period of time. Whether, you know, who knows how that will work out politically, but mm-hmm. you know, one would hope that it might provoke breaking down some of those barriers, but I don't know. You know, at a much easier level, I mean, we did see that recently in the UK, where the government, you know, the new government did change the approach to fiscal rules, and in particular the debt rule, in a way which allowed somewhat more public investment. Mm-hmm. You can argue that they will need to go farther and faster mm-hmm. if they're going to deliver on their ambitions, but it was at least a start, and one would hope, yes, you might see some of that in France and Germany, and indeed mm-hmm. at the European level over the next few years. But that will require some, you know, we have several elections to go.
Yes, especially the German one.
Especially the German one, yes.
Yes, I would like to ask a final question, which is, let's say an externality, but something, a factor that might bring the UK and the EU closer to each other. This externality is called Donald Trump. That now we are in a new age. I think nobody knows exactly what in terms of policies this will mean after the 20th of January, but there are various pointers, right? So we understand the direction of the policy chain, evolution, if not revolution, which some of them would like to see, and in a way trying to uphold Javier Milei as an example for deregulation and liberating the economy from public intervention and a heavy state sector and redistribution. So at the same time, the most critical point here is the possibility of trade wars, because the first Trump administration brought, I would say, a mild version of trade wars. And now there is a high risk that they would go back to this tradition. How do you see the impact of this on the UK, but also relations between the UK and the European Union?
Well, as you say, it's almost impossible to predict what Trump will do. And in particular on trade, I think it's very difficult to predict whether, in fact, the primary trade, you know, tariffs and other forms of trade war are focused very much on China and perhaps Mexico. And actually, while there will doubtless be tensions and probably some tariff wars in particular sectors like steel or whatever between the US and the EU, but actually that's relatively second order, as it was in the first Trump term. When there were trade disputes, but there wasn't anything like a full-scale trade war between the US and the EU. And he may choose, again, that, you know, to focus very much on China, and therefore does not mean the EU will be unaffected, but it doesn't mean that we will have a generalized trade conflict. So we don't know what's going to happen. We can, I think, anticipate that at least some European leaders will be tempted to try, you know, including the UK, but also some other European leaders, particularly those that are more ideologically sympathetic to Trump, and we know who we're talking about here, will be tempted to try and make some sort of direct deal with Trump, EU trade risk policy notwithstanding. And that obviously could lead to some pretty unpleasant internal divisions in Europe. And I think that is probably a big risk.
Isn't it kind of ironic that it was the US which brought both Mexico into the NAFTA, China into the WTO, and now, because of the enormous deficits, they are trying to resort to, you know, tariffs or even a tariff war?
I mean, I think, you know, there is very little economic logic to anything Trump says, obviously, when it comes to trade. How that tension works between the idea somehow that the US is subsidizing China and Mexico, when if anything it has been the other way around for some time, and the fact that at least some of the people he's picked on the Treasury and so on are slightly more orthodox, you know, not necessarily of the same ideological persuasion as you or me, but they are more standard issue Republicans who we don't know how those internal tensions will play out. Clearly, the EU has to be ready for a variety of scenarios, and in particular for scenarios in which there would be significant disruption to US-EU trade. And equally, the UK has to be prepared as well. I mean, the UK, I think, is hoping that it won't have to make sort of big decisions or choices. And that's quite reasonable, I think, from the UK point of view, that to hope that we will not be put in that position. But equally, we have to prepare for the fact that we might have to. And in that case, the UK clearly cannot and should not side with Trump in any meaningful sense in a EU-US conflict, but equally we have to preserve our own interests.
Can we conclude that the EU would be safe if it can stick to and kind of recommit to multilateralism, especially in trade and economic relations, and perhaps the UK also would side with the Europeans if what is at stake is the future of the multilateral system?
Unfortunately, the EU cannot unilaterally enforce multilateralism on the globe, right? If there is a US-China trade war, and the US then says to the EU, well, you have to join us in this range of tariffs on China, or these components of goods, not only can are we going to impose tariffs on China, but we're going to impose various types of rules of origin relating to a whole range of components that cannot be fabricated in China and then shipped on to the US. The multilateral system in its current form will not exist anymore, right? No matter what the EU does, not because the EU chooses, but simply because if there is a really major trade conflict between the US, which the US is determined to wind to the rest of the world, then the EU will have to work out how to deal with that. It will not be any good for us to say, well, we want the WTO and multilateralism back, because it simply will not exist in its current form. And so we have to be prepared for that. That is the worst case scenario, but it's not a completely inconceivable one either, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. I don't insist on any particular silver lining at the end of this conversation. And as you use the word prepared, this resonates with the Brussels narrative of 2025, and everybody speaks about preparedness. Let's leave this there, and we should see what this Trump era.
I still think that the best defense for the EU to these very real threats from Trump and the possible other threats to multilateralism is still for us to get on and make our own model work, the European model, which, as I say, the UK and the EU share, of hopefully a dynamic economy with a strong element of social protection and redistribution. We need to make that work. We can make it work, but fundamentally that is in our own hands, the threats from outside notwithstanding. We need to reform, we need to invest within our own countries and within Europe as a whole, and if we do that, we would have to worry much less about what the rest of the world does.
Thank you so much for this positive conclusion and for the entire conversation. And I suggest that as things develop, we come back again and follow these developments in the United Kingdom, but also in the European Union. Thank you.
Thank you.